Into Nehemiah this evening. We're ready for chapter 2, so please go ahead and open your Bible up to Nehemiah chapter 2 for our lesson this evening. I really enjoyed covering chapter 1 with you on Sunday. We had lots of good comments, and I think there's going to be plenty of room for that in tonight's lesson as well. So we talked about Nehemiah depending on God. We said that in those last 8 verses of chapter 1, God is mentioned 34 times by name and pronoun. So anytime you're talking about God 34 times in just 8 verses, you're obviously leaning on God and depending on God. So that was a profitable study for us. Tonight, I'm excited about the vision that he is casting in chapter 2, bringing people on board with what God has put in his heart in helping to rebuild the walls of Jerusalem. We want to just remind everyone kind of how we're outlining this book as a whole. We said that in chapter 1 and chapter 2, we really have this story of how Nehemiah comes back to Jerusalem. In chapter 3 through 6, generalization, he's rebuilding those walls. And that's where we're getting our first big idea of rebuild. In 7 through 10, restoring the people's faith. This is when Ezra is reading the law to the people, really stirring up their commitment and devotion to the commandments and ordinances of God. And then he goes back, he reports to the king, and he has to come back and kind of shake them up again, renew their worship. And so we said in chapter 11 through 13, we get a lot of information about how he's renewing their worship. Our goals for the class are pretty straightforward. We're going to look at 3 special ones tonight. We said to learn from Nehemiah, to align our hearts. That's what we talked about a lot on Sunday. To engage in good deeds that honor God. I think there's some great strategies for that tonight. To depend on God. We did that more on Sunday. Incorporate prayer. We're going to look at his little quick prayer. I don't remember who told me. They called this an arrow prayer, like just pulling an arrow back, shooting it up real quick, kind of the arrow prayers of Nehemiah here in chapter 2. And then lots of leadership lessons here in chapter 2. So many things to soak in from this incredible leader and the teamwork that he encourages here. So if we want to just zoom in on chapter 2 itself, tons of stuff is happening here. In verse 1 through 8, we have the dialogue of him actually requesting help. There's some great lessons to take away from how that conversation goes and some principles of communication, especially respectful communication in verse 1 through 8. Verse 9 and 10, it's just that it's hard to keep a secret, right? The news of his arrival starts to spread through. And just imagine how exciting this would be. Approximately how far was it from Jerusalem to Susa, or about how long did it take to make that journey? Either answer is acceptable. Approximately how far or how long? Yes, we know that Ezra, it took him 4 months, so probably Nehemiah, similar time range. Anybody remember approximately how far? That's right. Yeah, 800 or 900 miles is a very good approximate, just depending on the exact route. So if we were driving it today, somewhere in that general range. So here you've got this guy that comes in. He's got all these official people with him. Ezra did not have soldiers. Nehemiah did have soldiers. You're going to notice that, right? So the news of his arrival begins to spread throughout the region. Verse 11 through 16, Nehemiah and his closest friends or closest partners, they go out at night and inspect the wall. Some great principles from that section, 11 through 16. 17 and 18, he does cast this vision, which is where our title for this lesson is coming from. He goes public with these big plans, and he does that in a very effective way. And then 19 through 20, there is immediate opposition. But he takes that opposition and turns it into an opportunity to express his confidence, not in his amazing strategies, not in his infinite wisdom, but to express his confidence in God, because he's been leaning on God every step of the way here for the past 4 months, if not longer. And so we have that opposition turned into opportunity to praise God here at the end of the chapter. So let's get somebody to start for us by reading verse 1 through 8. Nehemiah chapter 2, who wants to read verse 1 through 8 for us? Okay, thank you. Very good. Even in verse 8, still giving God the credit. The good hand of God was upon me. So I ask you in thought question number 1 to think about what we've just read. Think about Nehemiah's conversation with King Artaxerxes. How would you describe Nehemiah's attitude and approach in addressing the king? So anything in these first 8 verses here is total fair game. Pull out what you want to pull out. What would you say about his attitude and approach? Okay, very respectful. Absolutely going to come across as respectful. Any phrase in particular on that or just general observation? Very good. Yes, if it pleases you. So I'm not here just driving this home, being demanding and self-centered. I'm thinking about you. There's a great address, great kind of intro there. Yes, ma'am. Great. Yeah, so there's a closeness, even though Nehemiah is a servant to the king, there's clearly some kind of relationship because the king doesn't just look at him and say, oh, he's just a peon, nobody cares about him. No, he actually cares and he stops and inquires. Yes, Steve. Isn't that a neat balance? Yeah, so if we really look at this, part of this is, yes, the respect and the relationship, but also the fear. Because he still knows that he's talking to someone that's, you know, above his pay grade. That he's talking to somebody that's very powerful, even can sentence him to death if he chooses. Like, this is an intense conversation. And he has something really important on his heart. So you can be afraid sometimes, I don't want to mess this up. And you can be afraid, like, oh, I didn't know I was going to say this in front of everybody. Right? So all of those things can kind of be a source of fear. Yes, sir, Ronnie. Very good. Very good. So think about that. So he's saying there seems to be a comfortable relationship that he can even say, why should my face not be sad when the city, verse 3, the place of my father's tombs lies desolate and its gates have been consumed by fire. You know, with Esther, she had to kind of go in uninvited to address the king. Yet in this passage, Nehemiah is a little different. The king is asking him questions. The king has noticed his sad face. And so, you know, rather than an interruption, Nehemiah seems to have actually tried to maintain his composure for months. But it's just been building up and building up and building up. And he just can't walk in to the king one more time and keep the tears choked back. Or to keep a perfect smile upon his face, because it's just been building up under the surface and it's coming out in this conversation. What else? Anything else you notice in this conversation? Yes, ma'am, and then over to Blaine. Yeah, so once it gets some momentum, he asks for everything, right? Everything he needs. Blaine? Great. So he knows this is a busy and important man, and he boils it all down, and he's clear and concise, and he speaks to him with that clarity, which is another indication of that respect there. Anything else you want to pull out here about attitude and approach with the king? Yes, sir. Very good. So I just tried to do the respect side first, and then we're going to have 2 slides on the prayer. So let me just pause on that one, and we'll circle back to verse 4. Because that was a hard choice, like what order to cover this in. So let's get broad, and then we'll zero in on verse 4. Great question. Yes, sir. That's right. Yeah. Yeah, don't be a party pooper. Like, you don't need to be here right now doing this. Like, very good. So let me put a couple things, and some of these are going to be repeating what you've already said. There seems to be good timing on Nehemiah's part, because wine is before him and the queen is beside him. So unlike Esther, as an interruption, he belongs here right now. He is the cupbearer. And the queens were known to be influential in the Persian Empire. And so it's probably a good thing that the queen is with him. This is good timing on his part. Not only is it good timing, but super respectful in his opening, right? Let the king live forever. We see this with Daniel. Even when Daniel has to talk to very sinful, worldly kings, Daniel is always respectful to those kings. And we see that coming across with Nehemiah. Not only just a good opening, but what Blaine had pointed out, clear and concise. It's a direct response to the question. He doesn't just chase some trail somewhere else. He shows that it's emotionally important to him. It's socially important to him. He's just very clear and concise in the way that he addresses the king. And that respect at the beginning wasn't just to butter him up. He's consistently respectful as he continues to speak to him and as he continues to bring up things that are really on his heart. If it please the king, in verse 5, and if your servant has found favor before you. We noticed in chapter 1, Nehemiah using this language that I'm your servant. I only want to do this if this is what you want me to do, Father. And now again to the king, I'm your servant. I'm only going to do this if this is what you want me to do. So continues to show that respect and humility. Really cool detail in verse 6. So it pleased the king to send me, and I gave him a definite time. There's some expectation and reliability that Nehemiah communicates with. You know what? If you give me permission, you can count on me to go do this work, and you can count on me to come back at this time. There are plenty of times that the kids will ask me for something like, yeah, we'll do that eventually. You know, we'll do that soon. And they're going to nail me on it. Can we do it this afternoon? Can we do it when we get back from church? Andrew's wanting some new tennis shoes. He asked us at 6:30 tonight. Can we still get my shoes today? Like, buddy, I think you know the answer to that one. We're not going shoe shopping after church tonight. You know, like, but they're wanting something definite. And we all feel more respected when people give us an idea of the time constraints that we're under or the time expectations that we should have. I love verse 6, that he gave him a definite time. And then just imagine verse 7 and 8 as if you're actually journeying from Susa to Jerusalem. Well, it's going to take this long. And if I go on this journey, I'm going to need these kind of supplies. And I know what I'm going to need when I get there. I need a place to stay. So I need not just resources for the walls and for the gates, but even says, for the house to which I will go, verse 8. So time, supplies, the route, they're all in his mind. Because as we saw in chapter 1, he's put a lot of thought into this. He was ready for this. Now he needs the prayer in verse 4, and we have to zero in there. But there's some forethought. And this is something that is a great example for us. If we're going to make the big ask, if we're going to ask people to really get on board and buy into the good works we would like to pursue for God's glory, it deserves that foresight, some thoughtfulness to say, what are some of the things that I can see coming and some of the real needs that I'm going to have, and how can I communicate those concisely, and how can I communicate those respectfully at the right time? All of that comes together beautifully in chapter 2. So, is this enough? No. Not without God. Guys, you can check everything on the list. And Nehemiah could have done all of this, and it could have been textbook examples of good communication. But it's not enough without God. He's looking for God's favor. And in verse 8, the king granted them to me because the good hand of my God was on me. When we want to communicate with others about good deeds that are weighing on our hearts, it still depends on God. So we have this awesome prayer in verse 4. The king said to me, "What would you request?" So I prayed to the God of heaven. This is not the only two options, but let me phrase a question this way. Do you think his prayer in verse 4 is more likely seeking help. So let's just assume that it's a prayer for help. Okay, it could be a different kind of prayer, but let's assume for a second it's a prayer for help. Do you think he's asking for help? What should I say to the king in this moment now that he's noticed my sad face? Or do you think he's asking, how should I say what's already on my heart? Do you see the difference? And maybe you think, no, I think there's a totally different thing that this prayer is likely about. We're going to admit that this is a little speculation, but consider the context. Consider what we've already studied from chapter 1 and what we're looking at here in chapter 2. What do you think he's praying for in verse 4? Yes, ma'am. There you go. So give me the strength. Like, help me get through this. Help me not make a fool of myself. I know that this is important. Help me not mess it up. Help me not get in my own way. Right? That's what we're always praying before we get up on a Sunday morning. Like, let me set the cross in front of these people and get me out of the way. And Nehemiah seems to be wanting God's will to be done here. What else might you say? What do you think is going on in this prayer given the context of chapter 1 and 2? Yes, Clayton. I think that's very important to note. It's super short. It's just immediate. It's a very quick prayer. So it's not going to be some big extensive thing. I don't think we have to assume it. I think we know it was. That's right. Short prayers have a very useful place, and we don't need many words going on and on to capture God's attention. Nehemiah has definitely captured God's attention already. Yes, ma'am. Yes. Very good. Very good. I'm gonna come back to that comment in just a second. Anything else? Okay, I think Cherry's very much on the right track. And remember, so this is just for Philip. You know, I've looked at this chapter a ton of different times. Here's what's really jumping out to me this time. The best short prayers are based on long-standing prayer habits, aren't they? We need short prayers in our life. God, you know what this takes. Help. God, I need you right now. God, can you open this door? God, be with me in this. It's those momentary impulses where we're saying, I cannot take the next step without you, Father. And I need you. And you know exactly what I mean by that. Why? Because this is not the only prayer. This is not the only conversation we've had. When we see chapter 1, it's leading us into chapter 2 to say that these day and night and day prayers, he's just saying, yeah, that. It's happening. That thing that we've been so concerned about, it's right now. And so let your will be done. I'm trying to look for how I put this in my notes. I think this is likely a prayer for God's will to be done. A prayer for help in knowing what to say doesn't make as much sense. It seems more that this would be a prayer for God's favor and for boldness to communicate what he already knows he wants to ask for, less than searching what to ask for. It's not like now that he's before the king, he's suddenly going to say, hey, can I have next weekend off so that I can go to such and such thing? And here's the contrast. That's not what Esther did. When Esther walked into the throne room, she got nervous and she said, actually, just come to dinner and I'll tell you at dinner. And then he came to dinner with Haman, and he's like, actually, come to dinner tomorrow, and I'll tell you the next, right? Esther was still working on communicating that, and that's not a slap at Esther, it's just a contrast. Nehemiah really knows what he wants to ask for. He wants to go back and rebuild the walls of the city. And he's got these long-standing prayers that I think come out now in this short prayer. Do I see hands? Yes, sir, Ronnie. Yeah. Yes. Yes, let's say that God, please bless this. Bless this conversation. Bring this out for your glory. So we don't have a lot of detail, but it is a very short prayer. And it's a good reminder that God is greatly pleased with those short prayers that are from the heart and that are in alignment with His will and that have the kind of respect and humility that the rest of the chapter clearly demonstrates. Right, I'm going to watch our time tonight. Keep on going. Why is it important? Why is it important for Nehemiah to survey the city for himself with only a few close partners? We know this from verse 11 through 16. He comes, and it's not even in the daytime, right? It's at night after he's been in Jerusalem for 3 days. He takes just his one animal with him, which seems to be a detail that helps us understand he's not wanting to draw a lot of attention to himself. But he doesn't do it completely alone. Verse 12 says, "A few men are with me." So why do this? Why survey the walls privately? Yes, Steve, and then back to Joel. Okay, very good. So there's a huge sense of personal responsibility, and he knows that this accountability to the king. He's got to go see this. What else, Joel? Okay. Right, so he'd previously gotten a report from his brother, who was trustworthy to give a good report, but now he's got to see it with his own eyes. He's got to know the scope of this project. I love that term. What else? Yeah. Wait, Blaine, and then back. Very good. So it avoids some distractions and some things that may come up down the road, but he needs to get his eyes on it first. I lost track of whose hand was first. Put your hand up if you wanted to, right here. Yes. Good, good. So he's being very proactive. He's still being humble, but he wants that firsthand knowledge. Steve? Yeah, it is. So he's evaluating, how can I best help on this project? What is my role going to be here? He knows what part of his role was, securing the permission and the funds, but he's still going to have a lot to do here. So let me, okay, Jack, and then I'll go over. No, go ahead. Okay. Very good. So again, back to the distraction. He knows there's going to be opposition, but he'd like a chance to at least scope it out for himself before he has to answer a bunch of questions in opposition. Yes, ma'am. That's right. So I'll put it this way. He is taking time to develop and refine this vision. He knows what he wants to do. That's not going to change. You know, he doesn't know quite how hard it's going to be in some of the sections, but he expects a lot of work to be necessary. But there's some great things that he's doing. I think we would all say this, that great leaders do their homework, right? They don't get up and cast their vision and invite everybody to get on board without at least a ballpark idea of what's going to be necessary And if someone does challenge you to go, yeah, but you know about that one section over here by the refuse gate, that's just that we cannot get that done. He's going to say, I've seen it with my own eyes. It can be done. You know, he's really doing his homework there. Great leaders, they confide in a small group. None of us, not even Nehemiah, can go and survey the problem and catch all the details. This is why we lean on our close friends. We lean on our spouse to say, hey, this is what I'm thinking. And somebody will say, well, have you considered these three things? You go, oh, I considered two of them, but not that third one. I'm glad you mentioned that. I need to kind of incorporate and think about how am I going to deal with that particular contingency should the need arise. You work with a small group of people that already know your character, so you don't have to like prove to them, hey, I'm not crazy for wanting to do this. They know you're not crazy. They know that you have good motivations. They know that it's out of a place of humility and helpfulness, like a true servant, rather than you're trying to put a spotlight on your own reputation. You find that small group of people you can trust, and they help you refine your plans for that good work. It also will inspire confidence because people can tell that you've thought before you spoke. That makes a big difference. If someone starts being pressed with different details and questions and you are completely unfamiliar with the rest of the subject matter, you immediately begin to lose confidence in that leader. But because he's taken time to not only hear the report, make the journey, and now survey it, he's going to be able to address whatever might come up. And then this is the one I forget to squeeze it in, but it's a classic John Maxwell leadership principle. You prepare for likely objections and obstacles. Right? Like as you're making a 6-month budget and you're going to save up and you're going to go to Disney, just go ahead and put in $400 for a new set of tires. Because you're going to have a flat tire. Like, you didn't plan that flat tire, but there needs to be some kind of contingency. Like, if you're planning something, go ahead and just have a backup plan for if it rains cats and dogs, because that's all it's done the last 4 weeks. Okay? Have a contingency plan. You have to stop and say, what could likely go wrong here at VBS? It's like, you know what? All of these mothers that are volunteering for VBS, they have small children. What do small children do? Get sick? Who's our substitute? Should one of those women not be able to come to VBS on a random Tuesday? You have to think through likely objections and obstacles, and this time that he's taking gives him that. Why? Because we know there's no such thing as overnight success. Even in this book, when we see them rapidly complete the wall, when it is obvious to everyone that he's dependent on God and that God has blessed it, there is no such thing as an overnight success. There are people who've poured their time and their energy and their prayers into really crafting a well-executed plan, depending on God, and you have to do that work before you get to this big day and this big announcement. You take the time to develop and refine that vision among a very small group. Then you're ready to cast the vision. Then you're ready for verse 17. I said to them, you see the bad situation we are in, that Jerusalem is desolate and its gates are burned by fire. Come, let us rebuild the wall of Jerusalem so that we will no longer be a reproach. I told them how the hand of my God had been favorable to me, and also about the king's words which he had spoken to me. Then they said, let us arise and build. So they put their hands to the good work. Thought question number two. I asked you guys to look at these verses and pick out the problem, solution, reason to act, and reason to act right now. If I'm ever covering Nehemiah, if I'm ever doing a leadership lesson, you know I'm going to bring these four up because I've brought them up before. Can you find it? What's the problem he brings out in verse 17 and verse 18? The problem. That's right. You see the bad situation we are in. Sometimes people think all I need to do is point out the problem and everyone else will agree and then we'll fix it. It never works that way. They know the problem. They've been living with the problem for longer than he has. But he still needs to state it so that no one else can deny it. This is what I am here to address. What's the solution? Yeah, let us rebuild the walls. This is going to take work. We're not going to just wake up and one day, magically, the Ammonites have rebuilt them for us. We're going to have to lift these stones. What's the reason to act? Yes, that will no longer be a reproach. The reason to act is not personal safety and security. The reason to act is not personal safety and security. Because God is their protector. And God is their provider. And some people, if all it's about is personal safety and security, can go, well, you know, the wall by my house is fine. I'm sorry that the wall by your house is broken, but that sounds like a personal problem. You know, he is addressing the real why as he casts this vision. Not just these external issues, not these things that we could say are individual in nature. He's addressing the real why that applies to everyone. We are a reproach. This is not the way things are supposed to be. You've heard me use this phrase, what could be and what should be. We could fix these walls. But we could do a lot of things. We could ignore them and just continue to take care of our own family. We could always ignore some things. But should we? No. Should we fix these walls? Yes. Should we follow Nehemiah in fixing these walls? That remains to be seen, but he's going to be awfully convincing. The problem, the solution, the reason to act. What's the reason to act right now? Or Jason, you had a comment? Yes. Yes, it reflects poorly on them, and it reflects poorly on the God that they are worshiping. Because anybody else would look at that city and say, these are not the people that worship an all-powerful, all-loving God. Their God has forsaken them and left them. And they're not, you know, people from the outside are not going to look at it and say, oh, well, it's all because of their idolatry, but that was 70 years ago, and this is, they're not going to get that. They're just going to say, that's broken, and I'm not interested. And he said, we've got to fix that. We've got to change that. Other hands? The reason to act right now. What was the reason to act right now? That's right. God has blessed them. The hand of my God has been favorable to me, and also about the king's words. Now is the time to act. What could be? We could rebuild these walls. What should be? We should not let this chance slip by us. We have everything we need. The king has given us official permission, which is a contrast back from the days of Haggai, right? Where there had been all these legal challenges and the work on the wall had to stop. Now we have the king's blessing. We have the king's finances. We have the king's soldiers. We have everything we need to do this. How could we possibly let this go? So it's time to act right now. When we think about trying to communicate to others the good works that we would like to do and that God has put in our heart, we can communicate these four things. Here's the issue. Our Bible classes are in shambles. This is the conversation Tracy and I had to have when we were in Florida. There were public school textbooks in the kids' rooms instead of Bible study books. And we said, what's going on here? And they said, well, we really just treat this kind of like temporary daycare so that the parents can go to their class. We're like, okay, number one, no. And number two, no. So, like, this is a problem. We're going to have real Bible classes. If all we do is cover Noah and the Ark 52 Sundays a week, we are still covering the Bible with these kids. So, here's the problem. What's the solution? Well, here's a curriculum option. And we don't have to do this one, but let's do something. Right? Why are we going to act? Because it was a church of nothing but retirees and it couldn't stay that way. Why are we going to act right now? Because we're not moving on until we do. Right? Like, there's just some things you're going to have to do to step up our game. When you think about leaders who are casting a vision, it's just like these principles we've covered with refining that vision among close friends. Great leaders, they open their eyes and they see what could be and what should be. We could be a light. We could be a model of Christian families. We could be inspirational to other Christians in our evangelistic efforts. We could be extremely compassionate. We could be so many things. But should we? We always filter it through the will of the Lord. Lord, what do you want us to do at this time and at this place with this abundance of resources you've blessed us with? What is the best thing that we can do here? It's great leaders who will recognize what could be and what should be. You're going to see it earlier and more fully than those that are following. Nehemiah has known this for a while, but he has the wisdom and the blessing of God to speak up and really communicate it clearly and to help them come along. He knows how great the city could be. He knows that God's covenant promises are to bring people back, like we studied from chapter 1. Great leaders are going to see that vision earlier and more fully than their followers, and they can invite people to get on board. And they're going to have to repeat it. Just watch for this one as we go through chapter 3, chapter 4, chapter 5, chapter 6. When everybody else gets afraid, when everybody else is considering giving up, when it seems like, well, maybe the people that are carrying the stones are never going to be able to carry enough, so why should I bother laying the stones? It's doomed if they can't do their part. And then these people are over here looking at it. Why should I keep carrying the stones? These guys laying it are doing it with one hand tied behind their back because they've got a sword in one hand. And they're never going to be able to do their part, so why should I keep working so hard? All of these obstacles will keep going out. And what Nehemiah does over and over is communicate that vision. He communicates it clearly and he communicates it often. And leaders have to be the one that stand up and speak up to do that. And then, as Jack will kind of get into on Sunday, they formulate a plan to pull together the resources and the people that are available. Anybody can rebuild the wall with unlimited manpower, but they don't have unlimited manpower. Anybody can rebuild the wall if they have perfectly cut smooth stones, but they don't have that. They're going to have to work with the rubble and the stones that are on site to take the resources available and the people who are available and lay them out in a, what was this? I think maybe Joel said scope of work. Yeah. To lay them out to address the full scope of work, that takes real leadership. And Nehemiah is an all-star in this. So let's bring it home. What's our vision? What would your spouse or what would your children say is your vision for the family? What could be and should be in our family? Because there are some kids that they would answer it right away. Daddy wants me in the NFL. Right? Straight A's. I know that's what they want. It's defined by straight A's. But is there some things a little bit bigger than that that you have articulated? You're the leader in your family. Are you seeing more clearly than your children? Are you maybe seeing more clearly than your spouse what could be and what should be? And then speaking about that, not in a nagging way, but in an often way that shares what's on your heart with the rest of the family. We boiled it down to one word in our family. It's harmony. Because when we sing four parts here, right? I am not going to sing that tenor unless Grant's sitting behind me and I can kind of copy him, right? I'm going to stick with that little bass line. But when we sing four-part harmony as a church, it's because all four parts are different, but they go together beautifully. And my family, there's four of us. And we're all different, with different strengths and different weaknesses and different aptitudes. And we're not going to always do things the same, but we can at least do things in harmony. And I've tried to just really set that forward in our family. Second question, what could you and should you be doing? As you think about Nehemiah and his willingness to address this, what could you really do to make that difference for God's glory? What would Nehemiah say if he were here with us? He would say, oh, guys, you could totally do this. Do you see this yet? This is what your family could be. This is what your children could be. This is what your marriage could be. This is what your group could be. Like, your group leader could just love it when you walk in the room because they know you're willing to do anything. The deacons could love it when they see you coming. The elders could be so happy when you're in your pew. Like, what could be and what should be in your life? What would Nehemiah say to us? Wouldn't he say, there's lots of good work to do, and that we need to be busy with it? And finally, chapter 2, verse 19. When Sanballat the Hornite and Tobiah the Ammonite official and Geshem the Arab heard it, they mocked us They despised us. They said, what is this thing you're doing? Are you rebelling against the king? So I answered them and I said to them, the God of heaven will give us success. Therefore, we, his servants, will arise and build. But you have no portion, right or memorial in Jerusalem. You have to refine your vision. You have to go public with your vision. And you're going to have to defend your vision. And Nehemiah gives us three awesome things that we can hold on to when we're called to defend that vision. Number one, I know God's part. He had prayed about it for 4 months, and now he's made approximately a 4 month journey. So he's 8 months in. And after 8 months of moving in this direction, God has opened every door along that path and given him everything he needs as long as he had the faith and courage to keep moving forward. So at this point, he's running on 8 months of momentum. Is he going to let two guys making fun of him, or three making fun of him, stop him? Not by a long shot. He has total faith that God is with him on this project. So then his part, he's going to serve with zeal and with diligence. He is not backing down. And then how emphatic is he in verse 20? You have no portion, no right, no memorial in Jerusalem. If they had any doubts, he has taken that away. And his point is, look, I'm sorry that you're unhappy about this, but I never was doing this based on your pleasure or displeasure in the first place. This is kind of his Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego moment. Like, king, let it be known. You can strike up the band, but we will not bow down to your idol. However you feel about it is kind of irrelevant. And so Tobiah and Sanballat and Geshem here, their mocking and their criticism, it's irrelevant. The God of heaven will give us success. He is going to be pushing forward, and he's willing to defend that vision. All right, anything you guys want to pull out before the final bell gets us here in chapter 2? Refining the vision, casting the vision, and defending the vision tonight. Did I skip somebody's favorite verse? Yes, sir. Correct. That's right. It's like if they want to lawyer up and they want to send off a letter and try to get a letter back to say, stop, don't do this. That's kind of what they had done back with Haggai. He's like, not worried about that. I'm not rebelling. And probably what they're doing is phrasing it in such a way to create a rumor. Because we know they create rumors through the rest of the book to try to discourage people. And so it's probably a scare tactic. Great question. Yes, ma'am. Very inclusive. Excellent. Excellent. We're in this together. It's a side-by-side kind of leadership, not a put your feet up in a recliner kind of leadership. Very good. Yes, sir, Joel. Yeah, so the energy that he brings to it starts to rub off on others and can stir up their energy as well. Very good. Well, I've really enjoyed covering chapter 2 with you guys tonight. Thank you for the excellent comments, and we'll pick up in chapter 3 on Sunday morning. Good to be with you, especially our visitors.